Welcome to Music Fishbowl.
Hello everyone, welcome to Music Fishbowl, music chatter for all. It's Dan here and I'm back again this week. I want to do some housekeeping before we go any further. I'd like to thank Pat from last episode for guesting. He was an amazing guest and I really would love to have him back on the podcast whenever he wants to come on. I would also like to thank you all for listening actually as well, because obviously you are what keeps this podcast going, the listeners. Your lovely words and your compliments about the podcast mean everything, and I do this just for free. It's just a bit of fun to promote artists and accounts and things, and also to just talk about music in general, which is fantastic. Do check out the song recommendations playlist as well. I need to mention that too because I keep forgetting. It's just where I recommend songs on the podcast from the actual section that's the recommendations section. Myself and some of the guests have recommended songs. We put them in a playlist just so you can go and find them easy, and also because they're good songs, it's quite a nice place to just listen to some nice interesting music that you might not have heard before. So do feel free to go and look there. Other than that, the only other housekeeping is just to say, if you want to be a guest on the podcast or you want to ask a question to the podcast or anything like that, drop me a DM is preferable. So that's at thisisvinyl.tap on Instagram. That's at thisisvinyl.tap. Do obviously, if you don't follow, give me a follow, but also drop me a DM if you want to come on and just talk about music or promote your music yourself, if you're a musician, etc., all that kind of stuff. You just drop me a DM there. The email is musicfishbowl123@gmail.com. If you also want to send me an email, so that's musicfishbowl123@gmail.com. But let's move on to my guest today. He's absolutely fantastic in this conversation. His name's Tony, and he has an account on Instagram where he has his collection, records, CDs, cassettes, all sorts of stuff on there. That's Tony JW Hill, so that's at Tony JW Hill on Instagram. Give him a follow, you'll have hours of content to go through. He's got a great account, really, really, really worth following. Another thing I actually want to mention about Tony though is that he is obviously someone with a huge in-depth knowledge of music, and it comes across in the conversation we have about it. We talk about all sorts. We talk about Springsteen, Bob Dylan, we also talk about the 90s, we talk about, you know, the grunge rock scene, we talk about state of the music industry right now, record collecting, all sorts. And a place where you can go and see more about his in-depth knowledge of music is actually Tony's blog. It's called Mumbling About. And you can find it at mumblingabout.com if you type that in. So mumblingabout.com. I will put a link to it in the podcast description anyway. But I've been reading his blog lately since he sent me the link, and it's really good. It is really good, that's all I can say. He talks about all sorts of things, you know, from all pop culture things, but a lot of it's about music. So do go and check that out and read his thoughts on different musicians and artists and all sorts of things, because it's just a great blog. But yeah, without further ado, let's get into this conversation that I had with Tony, because actually it was... so insightful and it was brilliant. I really enjoyed it, so I know you will too. I won't speak to you again, but I will be speaking to Tony, so I'll see you next week. But enjoy this conversation that's going to play. Hello everyone, welcome back. I'm here with Tony, as I said before. Tony is on Instagram. He has got an account where he shows his music and his collection. It's at Tony JW Hill, so do go follow him there. But for now, I'd like to welcome Tony. Hello.
Hi Dan, how you doing?
Hi, I'm very good, thank you. You okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. So I've got Tony on, obviously, because he's a huge music fan. So let's start off there, Tony. What kind of music are you into? What genres, all types?
I'd like to think it's a pretty wide net. It probably isn't in the grand scheme of things. In many ways, you could probably say I'm sort of stuck in the 90s, much like most people who get sort of stuck with a music that was around when they were in their teens. But I go pretty wide, you know. There's a lot of post-rock in there. There's a lot of alt-rock. There's a lot of rock as well. Yeah. It's pretty wide. A lot of soundtrack stuff too floats my boat as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to have a wide selection, but I think all of us do have a target, sort of area that we like the most. So obviously on your Instagram, you do show parts of your collection. Are you a big collector, small collector? What type of things do you do?
I would probably start it out as a phase if I bought music in general, vinyl. Started, it was in the '90s, and so CDs were and that built up a pretty large collection that's now stuff in the garage. I started off small. I think I found a record shop in a town near me, which really didn't help the addiction. And then really started to grow over down and that COVID thing. You know, I think if Gogs and you can see the years you added to your collection, those years of sort of 20 to 21 are like when you look at on a tree and you can see the really big growth years where it grew a lot. And I think COVID years, it probably grew a bit more than usual.
Yeah, I think it did for all of us, because I think it's not just, you know, I think for everyone, whether, well, actually maybe not for all of us. I mean, I know it did for me as well. I think when you stop actually being able to do things that you spend your money on, suddenly, as long as you're still having an income, which I luckily was able to in COVID, I know not everyone did, but luckily I was able to, you can end up spending it elsewhere, I think. I don't know if that's the same for yourself, but I definitely increased my collection during lockdowns just by buying in from Amazon, as in a lot from Amazon.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, I was furloughed from the word go, but again, if you're not, I'm very lucky in this respect. So I know it sounds privileged, but I'm very aware of how lucky I was to still have, you know, after the mortgage and stuff goes out, still have a disposable enough an income where I could still buy records. But you're not going out, you're not doing anything other than queuing up at the supermarket on a morning somewhere. And do you remember those days, queuing up outside a supermarket and wearing a mask to just go around and wait for someone to move away from the product so you could go to them? So and then not so much Amazon, but certainly hitting Discogs and things a lot more.
Exactly. I mean, I've It's funny with my collection, because I started when I was 13 years old. So it's quite a while back now. But I rarely bought online for years, up until I probably finished university. I was collecting in shops because I couldn't afford to buy things online. And then suddenly, once you start getting a job, you can then start affording. So I used the lockdown period to buy the expensive stuff I wanted because I had even more.
Yeah, you're not paying money for travel. You might as well pay it for postage. I think the other thing, the other incentive was really, for me to support, you know, those local shops who, Amazon would be making that money anyway, but your local dealers, they're shut up. The online is the only thing they'd got. So it's just a way of supporting those, so that when you can go back out and buy, they were still there.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think actually since COVID, I've noticed shops popping up left, right and centre now. I'm really starting to notice more and more, because I think I really feel like there was a turning point during the pandemic where people really got into collecting who weren't into it already than before, and especially in the UK, I think. I think people just found a new hobby, because they probably went up to the loft, thought, "Oh, we're going to start searching around." Found a load of old records that were their parents or their own from the past, and decided, "Oh, let's hook up the record player that's up there again. Let's give that a go." And then they go, "Actually, let's upgrade the player."
Yeah, absolutely.
"I'm saving money at the moment. Let's upgrade the player." And I think a lot of people did that. So I feel like the hobby got into a better place, because I mean, my opinion of the hobby is that it's always in a good place if there's lots of people who are into it. The problem with that is then it becomes not a good place, because people started getting fleeced for money because the labels are putting out new pressings that are way too expensive and things like that, and they're going to capitalize on the cost and make the prices up of things. And so it's healthy, but not at the same time. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest example, I mean, is you found labels thinking that because vinyl's on a resurgence, everyone's going to want to buy everything on vinyl. And there was a thing, I think it was last year or the year before, when Adele had a new album out, and it shut down vinyl production ahead of that in France. And any website you look at now, that's always going to be on sale for less than half price, because nobody wanted it on vinyl. The people that were buying that album weren't buying it on vinyl. They were probably downloading it, or CDs at most.
Just streaming it, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's been on Amazon for ages. You just can see it regularly goes down to like 11 quid, the album, clear vinyl. And you're like, I'm not an Adele fan.
No, not at all.
I even sit there and go, just because it's cheap, no. It's just out of pity.
Pity buy for Adele, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing though how
I mean, it's funny because that's another part of the record collector community. I know people who will say, well, it's limited to 10,000, so it's quite a limited release. And I go,
10,000?
Some artists, that's like that. That's their full run.
That's an entire run. They'd love to sell a tenth of that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a bizarre world that we now find ourselves in with the hobby. Mm. I remember going to charity shops and picking up, like, you get like London Calling by the Clash for £1 because no one wanted this stuff, but apart from a few of us. And now it's just huge. Just huge.
Yeah. I mean, when I started buying, I think one of the first ones I picked up, I'd got a few as a gift. And I think even before I had a turntable, I think one of the first ones I got for myself was up at Camden. I think, yeah, it was a mint copy of Tunnel of Love, the Springsteen album. And I paid a fiver for it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's still, that's a relatively regular play because that's got to be in my top 10, I reckon, that one. And it's, yeah, but I don't think I'd be able to pick that up again for that price, even if I went on eBay or Discogs, not in that condition.
No.
Same with, I think I got a first press of Hounds of Love as well, a similar price.
Mm.
And you just can't do it now because the prices have soared.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm a huge Springsteen fan. He's my favourite artist. And I've got Tunnel of Love on a picture disc.
Oh, yeah.
And I picked that up. Around, I think I picked it, it would have been 2018, 19, because it's pre-pandemic, post-university, so it would have been around then. But I picked that up for £8, and I'm sitting there going, that's never going to be £8.
I don't think you'd pick up the single on a picture for £8 these days, let alone your album.
No, you wouldn't at all. No, definitely. It's a very new world that we live in for vinyl collecting, but it's a welcome one, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, although now I'm going to have to look out for that picture disc just for the sake of completism. Yeah,
exactly. Well, that's something I've done recently in the, you know, in the last year. I found myself a single man again at one point in the last year, and I was able to just sort of complete my Springsteen and Dylan sets. So I've now got, whether it be on whatever, I only have one copy of each. I'm not going to multi-buy variants. So, but I've managed to get every Springsteen album best I can. And yeah, but that's a costly trip when you're paying like £40 to get.
Yeah.
Well, £40 is not much for a lot of people. When you're paying £40 for, you know, Working on the Dream, you're like, oh, I've got to pay it because I've got to finish it.
Yeah, if it's Working on a Dream, I'll wait until there's a repress because it's not the best. It's not the best of that. It's not even the best of the Brendan O'Brien era. But
no, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If it was Magic, no. I'd be right there with you.
Oh, Magic's fantastic.
Magic, I think, is very much an underlooked Springsteen album.
Yeah, to be honest, I think most Springsteen albums, I think his 2000s period was actually an exceptionally good period. Even if you take out Devils and Dust, take that out and just keep in the other, you know,
Why would you take out Devils and Dust, then?
Just because it's slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
but
it's slightly different.
It's slightly
I like
different,
it.
But it's a grower. Oh, yeah. I didn't listen to it for years until recently. I found myself singing. There's a brilliant line in. I think it might be Long Time Coming, but I found myself singing that, and then I went back and found, realized, what am I humming? Why am I humming my Silver Palomino? And you go back and you listen to it, and I think it holds up better than Western Stars.
Oh yeah, definitely. I agree. I agree on that.
Yeah.
Think Western Stars creates an atmosphere better, but I think the songs on Devils and Dust are just better quality.
I think it's down to production, honestly. Really? I've never really rated Ron and Elio. I think I feel he's very much a post-production guy. I feel like he tacks a lot of stuff on, and a lot of the stuff sounds a little bit tacked on, whereas the Brendan O'Brien stuff sounds a lot more organic. But again, different producers have different ways of working and bringing stuff out. I'm really curious, because you say that for 2000s were a great point. I think for the 90s were possibly even better if you can get past the first two. So you get past the duds on Human Touch, Lucky Town, Stronger, but there's so much stuff that you, I don't know if you've heard some of the stuff that there's, so you know, the vaults were locked tight, but there's some stuff that sneaked out, but there's I think he abandoned two whole albums before Greatest.
Well, we got this announcement that he's going to be releasing this year, which hasn't happened. I think the project's been dropped.
I'd be surprised.
This box set of five unreleased albums, one of them experimenting with drum loops, and it's just that.
Yeah.
It's basically Springsteen's drum and bass, effectively.
Well,
and it's like
it's that beat that's behind Streets of Philadelphia. You know, I mean, he calls it his hip hop album, and but when you hear that now, you've got to think early 90s hip hop. You haven't got to think about modern day hip hop.
No, no, definitely.
But
there's
stuff. I mean, Nothing Man came from that period originally.
Yeah, you can hear that.
It's like, yeah, I want to hear those because I think Ghost of Tom Joad is one of those, another one of those growing albums.
Oh, I think it's a fantastic album, and I actually felt like an album that I've never really got into with Springsteen is I'm even forgetting the name of it now. Why am I forgetting it? 2014, around then. It's got Dream Baby Dream as the last track on it.
Is that the one with Tom Morello all over it.
Yeah, Tom Morello all over it. It's too, I can't remember the name
it's,
of it.
It's
now,
again, it's too Ron and Elio, but
yeah,
are...
it's too disjointed. It was recorded on tour.
It feels like Tracks Disc 5 in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does. And the version of Ghost of Tom Joad on there, I'm just like, no, original, please. That is a song where it's Americana. It's what's his name? Steinbeck. It's
absolutely,
you know, this is what it is. It's meant to be that way.
Yeah, and I think the same. I mean, the thing that irks me most about that album, and I think I might even have said so at the time. So there's some really good stuff on there. You know, you've got Down in the Hole.
Yeah, just like Firewoods.
Harry's Place is a good one. It feels like it's like he'd been watching The Sopranos or something on there with Steve. But The Wall is really good. That's got that brilliant line in there, which is it's just full of sort of pathos, which is that Robert McNamara says he's sorry for Vietnam and stuff. But the one that gets me on there is the inclusion of American Skin.
Mm.
Because that, you know, if you got live in New York City when that came out first, that's such a big song, and then the version that's on High Hopes just feels like, you know, what is this? The solo on there is something like from an 80s tutorial guitar tutorial video. I just feel
I think it could have been a good record if he just stayed in one place in the studio, no guest stars, him and the E Street Band, really focused. Because I've got a feeling it feels like an album where he didn't write songs for the album. He just picked up things from here and there.
It is. It's a thumbing through the notebook thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I get the point that, like, at that period, he was just touring like mad. I get that.
Well, it was recorded on tour, wasn't it? I think there was a tour break in Australia or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's recorded in, like, three studios or something across somewhere. I might be wrong, but I think it's recorded in multiple studios as well. And it's just, I mean, when that happens, when I hear an artist has done that, I always think that's a risk. And I do think, oh, this could be really fine, or it could be a bit disjointed. It, you know, depends. But,
well, there's that as the example of it doesn't work. But then you've got REM's New Adventures in Hi-Fi, which was recorded at Soundchecks, multiple studios. And I think that's possibly their second best. But I think if you know, that album you wanted, that one where he was focused and what have you, we got that in, was it 2021 with Letter to You? It just took a lot longer.
Yeah, I was going to say that because I think it's one of my least favorite Springsteen periods, unfortunately. And I think it's probably because it's I become a teenager, got into music because I love Springsteen as a child because I was brought up by my dad. I think I got into him then. And it caused me, I also had the same with Bob Dylan, because my first Dylan album that came out was a cover of Sinatra tracks that came out in my time.
I haven't heard that one yet. I can't get to it.
I look back,
cover
album, quite good.
They just don't cut it for me. I mean, I haven't even listened to, I don't even remember what it was called, Springsteen's one last year. But it feels like, especially with Anelio, it just feels like karaoke for me.
Yeah, it is a little bit. It's nice to hear Springsteen's voice so good. It's one of his best vocals, but other than that, it is a bit karaoke-ish. And some of the songs, like What Becomes of the Broken Hearted, his version of that's a bit just like, I didn't need to hear this.
That's just okay. What's this added to the overall Springsteen catalogue? Probably not a lot.
No, exactly.
But then, does he need to at this point? The guy's been singing for 200 years. What does he need to add to it?
Yeah.
Same with
Dylan. I think that's what happened in the 2010s. It's kind of like he wanted to. I think he was on tour too much for High Hopes, so he couldn't really do much there. I think Wrecking Ball was an absolute labour of love, where he wanted to sort of have a little go with the Mumford and Sons sort of sound that was around and eking into all styles of music everywhere.
Yeah.
Wanted to get sort of Americana again, back into sort of the Western roots that he sort of has really grown into as an older man. And then obviously he did that again heavily on Western Stars. And these are two albums I've come back to and grown and on, but his three albums of the decade. It's really quite weak until Letter for You comes out, which is almost like if that was his last album, that's it. That's a swan song.
Oh, really. Absolutely. I mean, at some point a few years ago, before either of those, over on my blog, I did a, you know, went through the list of his albums where I'd sort of see them from personal favorite all the way down to least personal. Yeah. And I don't know if Letter to You, for example, would cut into the top five, maybe the top 10, but it's still a solid album. I wouldn't know where to put the soul covers thing, but you've kind of opened a tin of worms on the Springsteen stuff. We could almost have a Springsteen podcast
if we're not careful. Yeah,
but I have this theory that Springsteen is actually, for all his massive talents, he's actually a lot more suggestible or wary of public conception than you may think, because I've got a couple of bits of evidence for this. The first is that I found out that after he released Nebraska, you know, he basically took it out of his back pocket on cassette, put it out as it was. I don't think he was expecting it to be as well received as it was, because he then immediately didn't go back to carrying on with the Born in the USA sessions. He went back to his LA studio and cut another series of songs in the key of. There's a bootleg around of it. I think it's called Unsatisfied Heart, the bootleg. Mm. And it's very much of songs of that ilk. But the same could also be said in the 90s, when the poor reception to those two albums, he second-guessed himself again and so didn't release a couple of follow-ups. The next thing he did was get the E Street Band together and go Ghost, Tom Jones, etc. And I think that era that you've been talking about, that sort of 2000, late 2000s, what am I doing, is possibly a similar thing. He's casting around for something that he thinks people might want to hear to get him relevant again. And the time when he's actually allowed to really focus on and just do what he wants and put out an album that's really organic, we get Letter to You, which he outranks everything he's done
since. I think he's starting to realise that as time's gone on, because I think especially in a post-COVID world, we've started to really appreciate later albums by artists, to the point where some Dylan fans are starting to say that Dylan's post 1997, when Time Out of Mind came out, is his best period.
Really?
Yeah, some of them are. I don't agree, but some are. People are coming around to it. So I think Bruce is learning that the Rising and Magic have now become these revered little items amongst this fan base that people really like. I mean, especially I'm a more Magic fan than the Rising, but
I agree with you there. Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's one of those where it's my favorite, but I think objectively the better one possibly might be the Rising, just because I think he's writing with more purpose. And I sat down and listened to it and actually listened to every song. And I tried to pick out everything political within it. Nearly every song has some elements or has some political element to it, because it's charged by 9/11 and things like that. Like I can, it's got more purpose and
drive to it. The magic is charged by Bush and his war on terror. There's everything in there has an underline of that as well.
Yeah, and I think that's where I think that's the one thing Letter to You doesn't have, is it doesn't have that purpose. But at the same time, he's almost doubled down, because I think if you actually took the actual songs and actually did a like for like comparison with The Rising or with Magic, I think Letter to You would come up top. It's just the writing, as good as it is, it's not, it hasn't got that purpose in the same way. I maybe think maybe that's it. I don't know, maybe I'm just waxing some lyrics a bit here, but yeah, I mean, it's I think he tries to do a bit of that in Wrecking Ball, but I don't think, because Wrecking Ball's a bit, not disjointed, just a little bit drawn out. There's a few tracks that don't need to be there, and it's about 14 tracks long or something, isn't it? Or something like that, I think.
It's that CD bloke sting.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But yeah, it's a great topic to talk about, Springsteen, really. But, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think he's more swayed by public perception. When you compare him to somebody like a Bob Dylan, because they are so similar in so many ways in what they do, as in they are prolific. They are two of the greatest writers. They're the greatest writers in quite a similar way as well. The type of writing they do is not too far off each other. I mean, one being inspired by the other is you know, classic. I mean, just chuck a bit of Van Morrison into Bob Dylan, and eventually you're going to get close to Springsteen. It's not hard to see where he comes from. And then his own unique spin is what makes him, right? Yeah. It's like, but yeah, I think as a comparison, you can really see the difference between someone who cares about what the public thinks and someone who doesn't. But that's why Springsteen is one of the biggest celebrities in the world, and Bob Dylan is a cultural figure, but that
doesn't
people
have
don't
the
really...
same album sales either. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It doesn't have the same album sales. That he's not had the commercial hits in the same way, and it's like that's simply why.
No, he didn't hit the gym in the 80s either, did he?
No, he didn't hit the exactly. And then he didn't have Mark Knopfler have a look at him and go, oh hello, I like that. I'm going to try being a bit of that.
Well, you say that, but Knopfler did produce a good chunk of Dylan stuff.
He did actually, yeah, which is odd. He did. He produced, I think, he did the whole album and a bit of Infidels.
Infidels, and a lot of playing on there is down to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, the guitar playing on Infidels I love, but that's because I love Mark Knopfler.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But yeah, so obviously, we've been speaking about Springsteen a lot, and we've been speaking about. But
you do 2 hours on Springsteen and never exhaust it. You know?
Exactly. Your period of music that you love as well is also within the 90s. What was in that? I'm always interested in this question because my household growing up was just Springsteen and that was it. It wasn't even in the house, it was in the car with my dad, nowhere else. So, what music was playing in your household? Because some people have a really strong connection to the music that they grew up with that their parents played. I don't so much. So,
No Springsteen, but so. Well, I grew up, so I was a kid in the 80s. So the radio was always on more than, I guess, the TV is now. So there's a lot of the stuff from the radio. But I think the stuff that I remember really was a lot of stuff. My dad playing a lot of sort of Dire Straits. So that was in there. And that's still in the mix for me today because we touched on Knopfler and I cite him as one of the better guitarists out there today still. And I think his headband era probably did them out of long-term respect and credibility. Probably due. If it wasn't for that, people would probably be talking about them in a lot more of a revered way. But yeah, a lot of that growing up, a lot of the 80s stuff. And like I said, the radio was always on, but then moving into the 90s, I mean, what a time to be a teenager with everything coming out in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in terms of the 90s music that you're into, obviously, I can see from your account, you know, sort of a lot of alt rock with things like REM's in there. Who are your favourite artists from the time?
Now, I'd say hands down, it's Pearl Jam. And that stuff. The Britpop thing didn't really do it for me. I think, by the time I was finding my own sort of musical taste and stuff, I was sitting up later at night listening to the radio on my headphones and really kind of listening to what was beaming in from the States more than what was coming in from the radio here. So now these days I probably listen to more of that sort of American, what's referred to as the grunge stuff, that sort of Seattle scene stuff still holds big in my world from the 90s. But at the 90s, at the time, kids, you were a lot more siloed. You listened to this, you didn't listen to that. You were listening to the rock stuff, the alt rock stuff, you sure as hell weren't listening to anything that had a hip hop beat. And if you're listening, it was a lot more siloed than today. Now, I'll go back and I'll listen to pretty much everything from that sort of era because, it was just such a wealth of great music across all genres. It felt like a real bursting point. I've just recently added the De La Soul album to the collection. You had the birth of trip hop with Portishead and Massive Attack and all these great acts in the same sort of decade. You could spend hours on each decade and each year in those decades.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I a good question to ask yourself actually, because I'd like to know what somebody who actually spent time in that decade with the decade thinks of this, because obviously I was born in the 90s, so I don't have it so much. And my people I know, the late 20s, early 30s, very much like the 80s nostalgia is a thing, even though we weren't synth wave, all that kind of stuff's there. But teenagers now, it's definitely a 90s nostalgia coming in for them.
Yeah.
And they're all sort of dressing in the sort of cargo trousers and all sorts of stuff, the fashion that was around at the time, and they're dressing that way, listening to the Spice Girls, listening to Oasis, listening to the boy bands, early Take That, all sorts of stuff. What do you think of that as a because obviously
the one who went through it the first time around.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of the new resurgence of it?
So I love it in a way because it's always good. I think we are in a sort of point of stuck culture because it doesn't seem so. In the '90s, everyone was talking about borrowing stuff from the '60s. You know, everyone talked about Oasis borrowing from the Beatles, etc. But they were always putting their own spin on it. I'm not sure that's necessarily happening right now because back then radio and was the go-to default for getting that stuff out. These days, that's controlled by lowest common denominator stuff, really. But I think, I'm loving it, really, because I'm seeing this great resurgence of stuff. Like, there's a resurgence of the shoegaze scene, as it were, with bands like Bleach Lab and Bedroom and things. But part of me, in a way, it makes me feel really old, because while my son isn't that age, you know, I think it's probably because they're listening to their parents' music collection, and their parents are probably maybe 5-10 years older than me, and their collection is very similar to mine. So it's a little bit, but it's great to see. And even with the '80s stuff, I mean, it made me reflect on it because having heard so much of that as a kid, my initial instinct when you're in your teens is to move away from that.
Yeah.
And then now I'm going back and over the last couple of years discovering things like Talk Talk and just how rich that era, that scene is, or Ricky Lee Jones, for example. There's just so much great stuff in there that you kind of move away from instinctively, but as an adult and with retrospect, you go back and dig it up again. And the 90s revival is a bit weird, seeing stuff, the deaged stuff you probably threw out 20 years ago because it was already gone. But I'd rather that than some of the stuff that's come since, I suppose.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because like you just know that there's some you know, young person out there who's just gone out and they bought a few cassettes from a charity shop from the time and just got them on display just because of aesthetic reasons.
That's a bit of a weird thing, seeing people display cassettes and records. That's probably what drives the prices up. There was that stat a while ago, was it something like less than 50% of records purchased ever get stuck on a turntable? And I go, how many people are people paying £30 just to put something in a frame on the wall?
Yeah, I think it's the ownership. My girlfriend now, she's got somewhere. It's just ownership. And I mean, some of hers are for sentimental reasons, because obviously they come from family, they're heirlooms to her. But others she's got there where it's just, some of them even sit in my room because she wants them to be here so she can put them on the turntable. But they're just records that, you know, she's even just like looking at them and just holding them. She's not even that into music. She likes music, but isn't like me. But she just wants to own them, I guess. But that's part of collecting anyway.
Absolutely.
For us, there is the ownership thing. I've got some records that I have played them, but maybe only once, because I just kind of more have it to have it, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. It's the tactile thing that's lost in streaming and the online. You can't actually physically hold a product.
That's
one of the good things. And I suppose that's why things picked up in the lockdown era as well, because the art of actually getting a record out of the sleeve, putting it on the turntable, dropping the needle, sitting there listening to it, turning it over, it is more time consuming than putting it in the car on a CD or streaming it on DAB or what have you. And everyone had nothing but time during those years.
Exactly.
You had the time to indulge in it.
Yeah, it gave people a chance to sit down. I mean, people were reading lots. Mm. And if you're reading, you might just want something to play in the background. So it gave people a chance to do that. And also it's a break to get up from the bed, turn it over, then come back.
A reason to get out of your pyjamas that day.
Exactly. No, it's funny talking about these nostalgic decades that are coming back, because I'm very much seeing it with the early 2000s and
really
the early 2010s.
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, it's starting to kick in, but at the moment it's kicking in just as nostalgia for people who were there. So obviously I was in high school in the late 2000s, early 2010s. So for me, that's things like The Inbetweeners, shows like the TV that was on at the time. Think of like the reality TV that was on at the time. Things like Educating Wherever Town or the county, Educating Yorkshire, things like that. There's all the nostalgia coming back, and these reels are coming up on Instagram, and these TikToks coming up where they're just showing clips from it and all sorts. It's starting to kick in, but it's going to take a bit of time. But the problem with that period is it hasn't really got an identifiable music sound and things like that in the same way, I don't think. I think the early 2000s does, because you've got the cheesy pop, the Britney, the boy band, all this kind of
stuff
is there.
That's what you call that TRL era.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the one. And Yeah, but the 2010s just doesn't have it. So all the legacy artists from all the rock stars. that Stones track that we all like. That was Stewart's song. Yeah, that one.
Yeah, that one from 2010. I think Rod Stewart was probably already doing his classic songbook stuff by then.
I know. The album, one of the best albums of the decade for me was actually his album called, I think it's called Time, off the top of my head. And it was when he came back from the American Songbook. And it's actually a great album. If you haven't listened to it, it's really worth sorting out. I wanted to speak to you about something, because you mentioned something to me over, we've been chatting before doing the podcast. I wanted to ask you a question, actually, because sure. Obviously we do music recommendations on this podcast. You've recommended me an artist.
Top
Drawer.
Yeah. They're just this mystery band.
Know. Yeah. Yeah. Let people know how you found them and what they're about and things, because they are incredible.
Yeah. I honestly have no idea where they came from. I think this is that. The joy of streaming in a way. So I've talked all about the joys of Tantal and stuff like that, but obviously it's hard to expand beyond that if you're not also listening outside of it. And I don't want to be stuck in a rut. You know, I'm always listening to things like Six Music on the way to work, and I'll bung on Spotify more often than not. But I'd watched there's this massive, each episode is like 2 hours long, this Vietnam documentary on something a while ago, and I was listening to a playlist of that on Spotify, and that had run out, and I didn't realize that had run out, and you know, it just put something else on. I was like, what is this is really, what the hell, it's really, I think, like I said, it's got this sort of bluesy riffing stuff, and then it breaks into this, it's got this great organ piece in there, and it's from 1969, so you can just see them in the studio with this big old kind of B3 organ sort of thing going. And it's called Song of a Sinner. So there's obviously something that I'm not going to step into politics and religion here, but I'm more interested in the vibe and the voice and stuff like that. And it spans, what, it's 6-7 minutes long. And this band, I can't find anything about them. There's another, you know, it just feels like they just managed to cut this record at a time when that music was right for that moment, because it fits right in with all that, you know, that Vietnam era protest and 60s vibe. It was, you know, it's 1969. How could you not have that in your music at the time? And the whole album is of a similar nature. And then I can't find anything else about them beyond that. it's staggering to me that it must have been such a rich time over there in America with all these little labels. Not like today. I guess it's a lot harder to cut a physical record these days. You've got to have the talent to create the track in the first place. But once you've got that, the process of recording it on your computer and getting it up online is a whole lot easier than it would have been then. Then you had to physically find someone in the studio to cut the physical product for you. And there's another fellow I was listening to. I think it's his name's EJ McMahon, and it's kind of a similar sort of vibe. It's very sort of folk Americana, but it's a lot deeper as well. And he made this album, got lost in the scene because he didn't quite cut it. I think I read somewhere that he went to Hawaii and just ended up playing a cover circuit and then just quit.
Yeah.
And ended up becoming like a telecoms engineer or something until 30, 40 years later when people rediscovered it.
This is what I find incredible, is that these albums on Spotify.
Yeah.
How did they get there?
Well, that's just it, because I guess the labels that they were on, or, you know, you're often hearing about people selling rights for huge amounts of money. Springsteen sold all his rights to Universal for something like $500 million or something.
Yeah.
The idea of that money, crikey. But and then on the flip side, you've got Taylor Swift, who's desperately trying to cling back her rights. Or Jay-Z, who got his rights referred to him after so many years as president for Def Jam. Everyone wants their rights. But I think that's as a result of a time when they have their rights. You know, the rights were owned by whoever you'd signed to. And so whoever made that FJ McMahon album, for example, it's called Spirits of the Golden Juice. There you go. Whoever made that, whoever he cut that with album-wise, it probably sat in a vault gathering dust. It was eventually bought up by a bigger label, and then ended up on Spotify. Because there's stuff by big bands that you still can't find. I heard you last week talking about Garth Brooks, who doesn't allow his stuff on there. There's, yeah. I think it was a long time. I think Pink Floyd, they were very reluctant to go on there. I think they put out Wish You Were Here on Spotify, and that hit something like 15 million streams in a couple of days. So it was like, right, yeah, now that's done that, we're going to put the rest on there. The Beatles were famously reluctant to do it.
It's okay just to do it on Apple, didn't they? It's okay just to do it on iTunes.
And yet you can spend a lifetime hunting through all these obscure albums by artists that no one heard of since, you know, it's not even 40 years, is it? It's more than that. It's for, so it's 69. So we're talking, what, 50 plus years of obscurity before someone... Oh, hey, have you heard this song? Or, as is often commonly the case, like... people slipping it on a soundtrack because it's so obscure.
Mm, yeah, well, that's the thing. Yeah, look at someone like Tarantino, the things he puts onto a soundtrack that no one's heard of.
Yeah,
and then everyone just gets into it.
Yeah, and he did that in the days before streaming. You know, you'd go to the cinema or you'd hear that Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Yeah.
What is this song by this? And you couldn't dig it up on Spotify, so you had to go and buy it. I remember... You know, when Jackie Brown came out, he caused this resurgence in the Delphonics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you know, Bobby Womack's Across 110th Street had a massive resurgence as well. Yeah. And that was just a soundtrack just to a film from the 70s that not many people really knew about.
Yeah.
Not in the UK anyway, it wasn't a large film. So it might have been in the US, but not here. I wonder if this... I think it might be similar to streaming services in terms of films and stuff, because I know for Amazon, I believe this happens. I think it's Amazon Prime's one. This is why there's so many weird B-movies and weird stuff on Amazon, because I think what they do is they just buy a whole studio.
Effectively.
They just buy the rights to the whole studio, or they have, you know, or they strike a deal with the studio, and it's like, look, you've got these films we want, but we need the rest as well.
Yeah,
we'll just absolutely. Take it all and just have it all, just to fill out our streaming service. And I guess with Spotify, there's so much more on there than any other service, but... I guess maybe that's also the case, you know, maybe that same label that has Top Drawer on it also has, for example, let's think of another band. They might also have The Nice on it, which is a band that people still want to hear.
Yeah. Psychedelic
rock band, for example.
Good call.
I wonder if that's the case. I mean, talking weird, obscure psych rock from the 60s, I found a copy not a few months ago of Rare Earth's album, the one that's got the whole, pretty much the whole second side is pretty much made up of a cover of Get Ready.
Yeah. That's what, 29 minutes long or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, the first white band or white artist to be signed to Motown as well. Yeah, they were. It's on Motown. It's on Tamla Motown.
Did they? Wow.
Yeah. But this album's just weird and wonderful. And it's not even that psych, but there's something about it that's so weird. It just has this...
That's just it, yeah. It's like the musical equivalent of those bands or those films that used to be on at something like 11 o'clock at night on the MCM channel or whatever it was before streaming started. Well, if you want the new Avengers film, you're going to have to also take these 50 things. Maybe they're trade-off. Or it could also be as simple as once they're out of a certain period of copyright, it's relatively cheap for them as well. You know, no one's knocking on the door to negotiate with Spotify for better royalties on for Songs of a Sinner, because nobody, who are we sending this check? Do you exist?
Yeah, exactly. The band members probably don't even know it's there. They probably don't have a clue.
But I think those streaming services as well, you know, those films, they probably have access to, I think they're probably replacing films in a way, in the same way everyone talks about how streaming has changed people watch films or how films are made, because you have to get that hook to get them at the start. It's probably changed how people access that music too, because you don't get, you know, I remember you go to the cinema in the 90s, 2000s. You remember the Spider-Man film that had that awful Nickelback song as a film? Armageddon, when that came out, it had Aerosmith on there, these big things. You don't get that anymore, but you get them on the TV shows. You know,
I remember
when The Sopranos came out, and they never have. If you've ever watched The Sopranos, they never have like incidental music.
There's
no score in there. It's all those killer songs, and David Chase would just line up great song after great song, and you'd wait for the soundtrack CDs to come out. And
yeah,
you know, I remember sitting there one night hearing like State Trooper, Springsteen State Trooper, brooding out of speakers at the end. You know, what a perfect fit for that.
I know. Doo-doo.
And
I know.
Now it's for shows on streaming as well. People are getting these songs from there in the same way they used to get them from the cinema. They're getting them from the TV soundtracks, and people that are making these are going out after them and dedicating whole shows to soundtracks by this band on this episode.
And I think this links into something else as well, because I think there's that new debate, well, not debate, this new idea at the moment that Scorsese is pushing, where if a film is going, because his new film, although it's got a limited cinematic release, like The Irishman,
the Moon, yeah.
That's it, yeah. Like The Irishman, they're both 3.5 hours, yeah. Which is a long film.
Well, this one's 4 minutes shorter, Dan. This one's got viewed a wee quicker.
Sorry, 3 hours and 26 minutes, sorry. But yeah, they are longer films, and the idea is that if they're going to streaming, you can... instead of cutting out what you need to, because it's going to be a long film, people can pause it. They can come back to it the next day, etc. And I think we're seeing that in music, because even in, it's not just within the genre, but the genre I'm noticing it most as somebody who's a big part of, well, someone who's a big fan of it, not part of it, big fan of it, is in the country music genre. Oh, yeah. Now, bearing in mind, this is a pop based genre that's there for people to click and stream one song, not really listen to an album.
Yeah,
we've got major artists who are the poppiest artists as well, releasing 32 track albums.
Really?
Because of streaming, yeah, and it wouldn't have happened without streaming. And
are they releasing them physically as well?
They are releasing them physically, but they're not. But in technically smaller quantities. Double albums. Albums.
Are they short songs or?
No, they're all full length songs. So you're looking at a 2+ hour. Album, and yeah, a good example is Morgan Wallen's one of the top artists at the moment in country. If you, I don't know if you know or not, but he is.
I heard the discussion about him. Last week, and I checked that out. He said a few choice things, but
he has. Yeah. I don't know if I can comment on him privately.
Recognize his music, but I steer as far as Americana. I don't really go too country.
His second album was a double album, was labelled The Double Album, Dangerous, The Double Album. His third album, they've not even done that. It's just, look, it's just this many tracks, and that's how long the album
is.
We'll put it, you know, it's something like, it's 30-something.
Have you listened to it all in one hit, or do you do it
staggered? I had to do it in multiple, because my gym workout was stopped by that
point.
What
are you doing today? I'm listening to this entire album, I hope. Yeah. I might have to sleep in between the second half and the third.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an odd new world with that.
Well,
that
it's is completely counterpoint thing. Of this era. You know, we were just touching on in 1960s when bands would almost you had bands who had to fit X amount. You look at Dark Side of the Moon, that's 43 minutes long on the nose, and it was you were. If you look at those albums, if you look at the Aerosmith albums from the 70s, those first, three, four albums, 8 songs, 9 songs?
Yeah.
Because that's all you could actually physically fit on a single bit of wax without spilling it into a double. And double albums at the time had such a stigma about them that it was almost like a curse to release a double album.
Obviously,
in the 90s, when CDs became the thing, everyone talks about... Brothers in Arms being the big commercial CD. By the time they got into their heyday in the 90s, if you take Acting Baby, U2's great album, if you cut 2 songs off of that and brought it down to 10 or 12 songs instead, that would be held up as one of the best things they ever did. But everyone was into this era. We can fit 15, 17 tracks on here and 2 bonus international tracks.
Yeah.
Just because, it's the Jeff Goldblum quote from Jurassic Park. Just because you can doesn't mean you should do it.
Yeah.
But now I guess streaming has made that even, I don't want to say worse, but it's a bizarre thing for an artist to be able to say, I've got 35 songs and I'm just going to put them all out. I'm not going to apply. Is there quality control in there with this Morgan fella? Are they all good? Or is it a thing you think, actually, if someone had sat down as a producer and said, look, choose the best 12, work them up.
This is the thing. The idea is because he's sort of more pushing into trying to be crossover to get onto playlists as well. So he'll have one very country song, and it's the most country thing it's done. This album is my favorite because of the songs I like, not because of the album as a whole.
Right.
Of his stuff. And his stuff, which is the most country-based things he's done. He's then got the more pop country side of things, which is just the bog standard, what you'd expect. And then the stuff with the hip-hop beats and things like that. So he's pushing all three because he can then get into playlists all different playlists as well.
Wow, so I see, that. I see. So he's really, so it's almost like a marketing exercise rather than thinking.
Yeah, while someone like Zach Bryan, who's sort of his counterpart at the moment, two artists, he's obviously more in Americana space as well.
I've heard of Zach Bryan, yeah.
Yeah, he's done a 32-track album where all of them fit together and really? There's no change. Yeah, but then he's released next. He then releases a 9-track EP about 3 months later. Then the next year he releases an album of 11-plus tracks or something. And then after that, months again later, he releases another sort of like 7-8-track EP.
Are they touring as well? Where are they getting this time?
And yeah, they're touring as well. But his stuff is just pretty much him, acoustic guitar, and a little bit of production with it. Yeah. So I think they're very economic with how they can record his music.
It feels a little bit short-term mindset, because you've got artists who write all that, and I think, well, let's save that for the next album. Because we go back to Springsteen and this weird era before Letter to You. I remember whatever name he was going by at that time, but Steve Van Zandt used to say that on any given day, Springsteen would have at least 2/3 of an album in his back pocket, in his notebook,
ready to go.
And then I remember reading, actually, he was no longer writing every day. He kind of lost that spark. I think somebody gave him a guitar at a show, like some fan gave him a cheap acoustic guitar, and that's where he got the burst of songs that became Letter to You. Can you imagine being that fan, knowing that that's what you did?
I know.
If you've got 39 songs from your first album, you'd think, right, actually, might lose this in a couple of years. Let's hold on to these so that when the record label says, have you got another album ready, Dave? Actually, I do. I don't need to worry about those running out. I mean, can you imagine if Rivers Cuomo got out of this? We'd have even more Weezer every year.
I know.
It's just absolute dumping of stuff on people. But that's quite interesting. I think the other thing is that it's, I don't know if they're doing this, but this thing of people going back and editing albums once they're on the streaming service because they're not physically released.
Yeah, that's a new thing. They do that with films and stuff as well. Yeah.
That's a weird one.
Yeah, it's the idea. I mean, to be honest, there's the idea with Bob Dylan where his songs are living, breathing organisms. So they grow and change as time moves on.
Especially
so when he plays them live, they are completely different. There is that idea. But Bob's never really changed lyrics. He has occasionally, but not really. He's not big on that. He's never done anything to change the song so much.
The Alicia Keys lyrics.
I've been watching some clips of him online for this latest tour, and I have no clue really what's going on with it. It just looks like an absolute mess, but it's the kind of mess that if you didn't get that at Bob Dylan concert, you'd be a bit disappointed.
You don't go to a Bob Dylan show and expect him to play Tangled Up in Blue as it is on Blood on the Tracks. But the counterpoint of that is, did you see that he played that surprise set at Farm Aid this year?
Yeah, I did.
Most of the Heartbreakers backing him.
But
I don't think it was announced. And it wasn't until he actually hit the chorus that I think most of the audience knew, A, who was on the stage, and B, what he was doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because he wears hats and he pretty much covers himself.
And it was so different to how that song sounds on, is it Highway 61? I think he played a trio of songs from Highway 61 Revisited.
I mean, what I find weird about him though is I've seen these sort of recorded on just like an old camera phone from like the mid 2000s.
Oh yeah.
Bob's shredding solos on his guitar, and I'm like, when did that happen?
I was like,
I didn't even know he was like this live at any point.
Absolutely. I read this fantastic story.
2006 odd, you know?
Read this fantastic piece in Uncut a while ago about a recording of Time Out of Mind. Mm. And a lot of the musicians that came into that were like, did he just do that? But there was also a period where after he'd been laying down those licks, he stopped playing guitar on stage and he just sat at the piano. And it was only recently he stood up again. But you've got to think, if he's been playing professionally, I mean, those first albums were just him and the guitar, essentially.
61, 62. 62
years, so yeah. But you listen to some of the stuff, because he's dugging it all out of the archives now, but if you listen to some of those, what are they called, the official archive sets? There's a lot of technical ability that gets overlooked because people listen to Dylan for the lyrics. People listen to Dylan for the protest stuff, the emotion of something like Sarah or Sarah and In Desire. They're not necessarily listening to his technical proficiency, but you can't write that many great albums worth of songs without having that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even when you look at his new music now, I mean, I look at False Prophet is a fantastic song. go back to Tempest. I love the album Tempest, and that's one when it came out.
Is that on the last one? Is that Rough and Rowdy? Is it?
Last one, because it's Shadow Kingdom a live album or a studio album? Because basically it is a live in studio, so it would be studio, but it was a live show with no audience. So it's kind of like, well, but he's I would say like an album like Tempest is one that was slaughtered when it came out, if I remember, by a lot of people. It's like, oh, this is just a new Bob album. Who cares? Yeah. But now people love Tempest, and songs like "Roll On, John" is all about Bob. It's all about John Lennon and it's a tribute to him. And it's on the nose Beatles references. But you're like, Bob doesn't do that, and he's doing it, and that kind of makes it interesting. And now he's perked my interest again. And there's a song in it called "Pain and Blood," which is incredible. Mm. And like, I just
because he used
and
to sing about Woody Guthrie pretty much on the nose with lots of references.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a song from Woody Guthrie, isn't it? On his first album. So yeah, there's a lot of good Bob Dylan stuff out there, especially in the last 20 plus, or even in the 80s period as now. People like Brownsville Girl and all this kind of stuff. People are loving this 80s period again now for Bob, which is a period that one used to like.
Yeah, I think because he kind of shot himself in the foot commercially, and I think people were wary of the his Born Again stuff. Especially after, let's not get into the religion stuff, but... No.
But some of the music is fantastic as well.
Infidels is great. It's a bit more what they call is secular, in as much as it's not a big Christian record. But one of my favourite Dylan albums is Still O Mercy. I think a lot of that is obviously down to the production.
You listen to
the bootleg stuff, the alternate takes and things, and it's not quite there. But Red River Shore is a song from that period, and that's just a stunner of a Dylan song, and it got cut off. You know, I remember people being up in arms because he cut Blind Willie McTell off of possibly Infidels. And he said something like, it's okay, I make loads of records, it will come out eventually. And it does. But Oh Mercy, I think, is just a fantastic album. I mean, most of the time, just that title, what's not said there? You know, I'm clear focused and all, I don't think about her. Most of the time, just if you phrase that differently, it's brilliant stuff. And
I know,
but I think again, because it's not A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, it's not Blood on the Tracks, it's not been featured in a Bruce Willis and Billy Bob Thornton record film, that people probably don't go back to it as much as they should.
No, I remember reading because I've read Chronicles, and it's one of my favorite books of all time. It's so good. I love that book.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a period.
There won't
period
be a volume
it.
Two. That's a cheeky no, thing on his behalf. Two. He's just he knows how to create that suspense.
Well, that's the thing. Apparently he was working on it, but he's kind of merged that into the philosophy of modern song, and he's taken because he found he was talking about all the songs he used to love. In there, and just sort of writing weird essays, and he's kind of taken bits of that out, and then decided to start writing essays, and that's why Philosophy of Modern Song as a book is a thing. But in Chronicles, he talks about Oh Mercy a lot.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah,
yeah. And I once saw, I don't know if you know musician Willie Nile. He's incredible. I love Willie Nile. I once saw him.
Rings
in
a big bell, yeah.
Yeah, I saw him in a 1950s diner being interviewed before a show, because he did a covers album of Bob Dylan songs, and he got interviewed by Clinton Halen, who's the premier Dylan writer.
He basically
said anything from the Oh Mercy period that he talks about is just him making stuff up. He believes that anyway, it seems. He says allegedly he's making things up, basically. And I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, but I think I remember him saying that. Not there on that night, I've read it online, that he said that, so it might be wrong. But and it wouldn't surprise me, though, because he had a very fractured relationship with Daniel Lanois, and he kind of does sort of like say I love him, but I also hate him throughout the whole period.
Yeah,
he's just like,
that's one of the things that came up in reading about Time Out of Mind, because they were working together again. It's just such a strenuous relationship between the two, but it built these two touchstones for me, at least, in Dylan's catalogue or more stuff. You know, I'll typically go back to his second album, The Freewheeling, Blood on the Tracks and Desire, and as almost, you know, those are free, but you could almost say you only need these. If you're going beyond that, get Highway 61. But I'd also say, Oh Mercy, Time Out of Mind, Daniel, he did such a great job, but it was such a fractured relationship.
I know. But I will say about Daniel Noir, though, when he's produced elsewhere, he produced Willie Nelson's Teatro record, I believe it's called. There's a song on there called The Maker, and the opening guitar, the tone of it's so gorgeous, and that's played by Daniel. He plays that.
Oh, really?
That's really worth
it. Well, you want to hear, he did a Neil Young one as well, I think it's called Linoise.
Oh!
The guitar tones are like, because that is Neil and his guitar, but it's Neil and his electric guitar. And that, there's some great tones on there too, but yeah, he's I think what he captures most, or what he's really good at, is painting that sonic kind of vibe.
Yeah, he's it's funny because, like, although the fractured relationship's there with Bob, he really helps Bob breathe on the records as well, and you can hear like because Bob's vocals throughout the 80s, Bob wasn't breathing in the music, if that makes sense. He was kind of just a lot of it, especially when you look at the
I see what you mean. And if you listen, thinking about that, actually, you listen to, I think it's Volume 8, the archive series from that period. Yeah, you can hear he's not the pre-production stuff for demos. Giving the right space to his voice.
Yeah, and actually, I've managed to get it on vinyl because it went to like £13 on Amazon. The Springtime in New York bootleg series, which is one of the newest ones.
Went to £13?
It went to £13 for free records and a booklet. In a book set. It's fantastic. It's so good. But I got it for that, and I quite like his 80s period. I don't have a problem with it, really. I know it's some dodgy songs, but there's some good stuff in there. But with less production and unfinished tracks, his voice has so much more space.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit there going, they did that 80s overly producing everything that they tried to do during the 80s. Born in the USA is overly produced to a level as an album compared to other Springsteen records.
Yeah, I don't go back to that very much.
Yeah, it's like, Bob's just not being given space, but hey-ho.
Yeah, it's the 80s. There's some production. You listen to that. The early 80s stuff is like kitchen sink. Everything is thrown at it.
Yeah.
But then there seems to be a bit more of a breather on some of it later. There's this gorgeous sound on albums like Tunnel of Love and The War on Drugs these days, I think, really tap into that with that same sort of... It makes me think a lot in a way of, you know, the Don Henley song, Boys of Summer. That sort of sun setting on a bright California summer day vibe, rather than the... Well, we found this instrument on a synthesizer and we're going to make everything thrown at that and build it around this big wall of cheese.
Yeah.
You know, it's the difference between Mr. Mister, I suppose, and that sort of Flock of Seagulls over production later era stuff.
The late 80s started, I think, I always think of, start of the 80s, it was more the new wave style of things, and things were sort of just kicking in. When it got to mid-80s, I feel like the music just got poppier and produced and just trying to make hits. And then when it got to the late 80s, it started to mature again, because you had people like Wet came out, and things like Swing Out Sister, these kind of acts were way more mature than what had been before. Yet they were still poppy, still fun, but they just had this level of, it was more soulful. There was, I don't know if you get what I mean, but it just feels they're classier. It was classier music, it felt like to me,
Yeah, I think it's being branded these days as yacht rock, isn't it? Or something.
Oh, there's also that as well. Weird. Yeah.
But
you get like George Benson fits into yacht rock as well. And it's like, he's more of a soul artist through and through, great guitar player as well. But he fits into yacht rock as well.
It's a weird thing. I wonder if it's down to you go back to the 80s here, at least you got to think about all those reps on the road in their car with the cassettes. Maybe that's what inspired it, because they didn't want to hear all the heavy production. They wanted a bit more space for crawling up and down the M1.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. Music production, management, promotion has changed so much over the last decade, let alone before that. It's a new world, but it's a new world that I like because I get access to so much more as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, I have choice.
You don't just have like two radio stations. Listen to all three, and the local ones.
Yeah, you can pick what you want. Although I'm still sad that there's no 60s station on DAB that I can find where I am. Anyway,
it's been not. I don't know if you're gonna have to, but that Absolute Radio as in the name. I'm not saying absolute.
Yeah.
Do they not have an absolute 60s?
They used to years ago, but it seems it's now down. Absolute classic rock is now the. So they have absolute 70s, 80s, and 90s, I think, still. But 60s is gone. Just absolute classic rock's their other one. And they might replace it with absolute country. I think
they're doing noughties as well.
Yeah, they're doing noughties now. They might replace it with absolute country because that wasn't a thing. But they've only really included that because Country Line Radio, which used to be Chris Country and absolute commercialization rubbish, called it Country Line Radio. No, Chris Country had the character. It's the same station, same people. It's just changed name. But
You're gonna have to use the Spotify radios, aren't you?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, anyway, Tony, I think we've gone way over what I expected, but
we might have done.
We didn't talk about
the 90s all that much, really.
I know. We've been over so much. It's been really good having you.
That's
on.
That's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. Obviously, we'll quickly debrief after the end of the record. But go follow Tony, everyone. Tony J W Hill on Instagram. He's got loads of great posts similar to what we all do in the vinyl community. For those of you who are also in it, loads of music stuff, and I'm sure he's happy for his comment and chat and all sorts of things. Thank you so much, Tony, for coming on.
Absolutely
in awe of any guests who wants to come on. So thank you
we'll
so
have
much.
To, we'll have to schedule a longer Springsteen chat or something.
We will have to actually. I've always wanted to do that kind of thing because I did it with McCartney once. With a friend of mine ages ago. But he could do the McCartney side of things. I need someone who can do a Springsteen one because that's really where I'm going to shine through. Or Bob Dylan one as well. Those kind of things. So
give me a call next whenever you want to do that, mate. I'm all.
Yeah, we'll do. Yeah. We'll do. Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. As always, I would have thanked you at the beginning of the podcast anyway. Have a good week until I see you again. We've got some great things lined up, so I'm sure you'll enjoy that. And I would like to say farewell to you as well, Tony.
Well, farewell to you, Dan. Have a great weekend.
Will do. Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Music Fishbowl, music chatter for all. It's Dan here again. I've got another episode, another week, another episode, and another fantastic guest. We'll get into that in a minute. I just want to start with a bit of housekeeping, though, and say thank you to everyone who's been sending me the kind messages about last week's episodes as well. It's performed really well, and I just can't believe everyone's taking their time to listen to my podcast. It's unbelievable. I actually want to do a bit of housekeeping in terms of the podcast playlist, which is the songs recommendations playlist. All the songs that are recommended in the song recommendation section that I run when I do the episodes on my own or that I did in the first series with guests, all those songs are in that playlist. So if you want to go and have a listen, search it up on Spotify. It'll be under my @thisisvinyl.tap. So thisisvinyl.tap on Spotify is my name there as well. It'll be under that. So you can go find that and have a listen to all those songs. There's a load of really good, pretty much all good music there because it's all songs that people think are great. And at the end of the day, most people's music taste is really good. So, especially the ones I have on the podcast. So, there's a load of really good songs there. So go check them out. You'll really enjoy them. Also a bit of housekeeping as well, just in regards to going forward for the podcast. If you wanted to be a guest on the podcast, do let me know. Drop me a DM on Instagram @thisisvinyl.tap. So that's @thisisvinyl.tap. Or send me a quick email, musicfishbowl123@gmail.com. That's musicfishbowl123@gmail.com. Just drop me a hello there and we can try and sort something out. If you did want to come on, that's whether you just want to talk about music with me or you're an artist who wants to promote, or even if you're like somebody who's written a book about music or something like that and you want to come on to promote it, do feel free. I'm always happy to have anyone on the podcast who is happy to give their time and, you know, really just enjoy the experience of being a guest. I'm very thankful to everyone's time. And someone who I am really thankful to is today's guest. Her name is Becky Brown, and she's a fantastic singer-songwriter who's just starting out with two singles out so far, one called Gone and the other one called Insomnia. Her new EP is the Gone EP, and it's out on the 8th of December. You can pre-save it now on Spotify. Her Instagram account is @Becky_Brown_official. You can find her on other social media as well. But if you go to that account, you can find a link tree which has links to everything, everything to do with her. That's in her bio. So do go and look for that. I will also say she's on multiple streaming services, all the big ones. So you can go to, you know, your Amazon, your iTunes, or Apple, should I say. It's Apple now, isn't it? Or you know, Spotify, for example, is another big one. She's on YouTube as well. There'll be some links to some of these in the description of the podcast below. So if you do just want to click a quick link, you can do it that way. The music, both her singles, the music will be played in the podcast as well. So you will hear her tracks. You'll also grant her a stream by listening to these. Well, just by listening to the podcast, you'll grant her a stream. So it is really helpful for her too. I can't thank Becky enough for coming on. She is a fantastic guest. And I'm really looking forward to you hearing her music. So I'm actually going to start off with one of her tracks. I'm going to play Gone for you now. It's a brilliant tune. You're really going to enjoy this. And when I come back, we'll go straight into the conversation I had with Becky about her music, her life, and everything else as well. So I hope you enjoy Gone. I'll see you on the flip side.